Hi, this is James Devine, and I am an educator who has come out of the trenches. Listen in as my friend and colleague Dana Goodyear shares stories and tips from other educators who have come out of the trenches.
Welcome to the Out of the Trenches podcast. This is Dana Goodyear. Thanks for listening. Coming up on 11 months of the Out of the Trenches podcast. If you like this podcast, please rate, review, and share on iTunes, Stitcher, and any of the sites where you download the podcast. It'll bring more listeners in. And also please share and promote on social media. Thank you.
My next guest is Trent Clark. He is the CEO of Leadershipity, having spent his adult livelihood among the top 1% producers in sports and business. Trent is dedicated to empowering people to reach their goals, peak performance, and attain their dreams. Having started 12 businesses, his dedication and energy given to his teams and the entrepreneurs he works with is infectious. But most folks know Trent for his 12 plus years in Major League Baseball and coaching in 3 World Series. Trent is married to his wife of 25 years and they have 5 children and live in the Midwest. Welcome to the podcast, Trent.
Thank you, Dana. I'm excited to be out of the trenches right here on the show, right?
Well, it's great having you on. Tell me about a time when you were in the trenches and managed to crawl out.
Yeah, I was just thinking if I ever got out of the trenches, right? Like, it seems like it's been trench warfare for a long time.
Yeah.
But, you know, yeah, I think that, boy, there's been a lot of times that, you know, as an athlete and growing up with a bigger family, I just think trenches were just not uncommon, right? Like, you know, and I think it's what built up a lot of character as we came through as kids. And, you know, I never thought about it as how hard that is to overcome. I think it was just so important that we move past. But we do in fact find that it is tough, and we see people every day who can get stuck and not be able to move past some really difficult things in their lives. So I really appreciate it. And I'm excited to be here and talk about a few things. So let's start there.
Yeah. Go ahead and tell me, you told me that you failed several times, right?
Yeah.
You fall down 7, get up 8 times. And, you know, you told me a little bit in the pre-chat about your, you started out as a teacher, you did your student teaching, and talk to me a little bit about how that had you move into working with professional baseball players.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I love the idea. I love that quote, right? Fall down 7, get up 8. I like the acronym of FAIL, right? Is first attempt in learning. I always love that acronym on FAIL. Like, man, like, and I come from the pro sports and baseball background, right? Where like, if you're successful 30% of the time on offense, you make like 10 million, right? Like, like, it's pretty good. Like, you know, it's not like school where, you know, you're not an A player unless you get 90%, right?
Yeah.
This is like, hey, you know, 30%, you're awesome. You're a superstar. So it's funny how the numbers change and how we adapt to that. But for me, yeah, I was a college athlete. I played both baseball and tennis at college, and I went to school to be a teacher. My father was an instructor at a junior college and taught high school before that. And I really enjoyed the teaching part, really enjoyed that a lot of coaches that I looked up to were also teachers. So I think that had influence on why I chose the profession. And of course, the ultimate goal was to play for years in the major leagues. And I never actually played in the major leagues. So when I came into college, I went to study in my education, and I was playing. And when I was playing, I could not do my student teaching. So I was very passionate about the learning and on the president's list regularly as a student, getting straight, you know, A marks. And because I just really love the education part. So when I got done playing, I was undrafted. And I went to play a little bit and some semi-pro things and stuff like that right out of college. And I did that for the summer. And then I came back to my fall semester. And the NCAA handed me a degree completion award, which was beautiful because it helped me cover this cost of going to work as a student teacher, right? Where I paid my tuition to get the degree for it. So it really helped. And I went to student teaching. And in that semester, I found out this is the last thing I actually wanted to do. And I had some doubts, right? I had some doubts going into it because when I was late in my university studies, we were on a quarter program and we would go in back to school like September 25th. So I would spend the first 4 weeks at school substitute teaching, making money. And I had gone back to my hometown, I think my junior year, and was substitute teaching with these teachers that I looked up to and really wanted to model my career after what how they impacted me. And sitting in the teacher's lounge, I was befuddled by the fact that the attitudes about students was really awful, right? It was really like, oh, these kids, you know, they're this and they're that. And I don't, and you really got the impression quickly, like they really didn't want to be here anymore. And, you know, in fairness to them, they really put on a great game face, you know, left the student lounge and went out and did great work, but it wasn't so authentic anymore that this is really truly their calling and they really felt that influence. So I was a little jaded at that point. And then when I did student teaching, I thought, I love educating and I love the study and I love to see people progress and learn, but the cadence and the schedule and the way school was set up, it didn't fit my personality and my style. And I was like, oh, I don't want to do this. And I was like, oh no, I'm all the way down through this education and now I have to do something different. And so about halfway through that semester, I recognized that this wasn't exactly where I wanted to be. And so I kind of put some feelers out there to see what was possible. And fortunately for me, the Detroit Tigers were looking for a strength and conditioning coach who I had been trained in exercise science and physical education. So I was excited and applied, and I applied to a few other teams and got a couple offers. And as soon as I was done student teaching, I went right to the Detroit Tigers to start coaching.
That's so interesting how, you know, you made that shift from your student teaching to working with athletes, but, you know, you kind of saw that, you know, those teachers you worked with when you were subbing just didn't have that passion. And we're seeing that today. You know, there's teachers that either have lost their spark or, you know, they shouldn't have been there in the first place, but you know, you were dismayed, right? But you made something great of that. And you found that you were still able to use your passion in working with youth. And I think how you were telling me in the pre-chat, how it felt like Groundhog Day, right? Kind of working in the system, yeah. You know, how everything is so, you know, the day lasts a certain amount of hours. You have, you know, each class period and you know, everything's so systematic. Right. And
yes.
But working with baseball in teams, how did that kind of change your perspective after leaving your student teaching and then working with students and, you know, helping them succeed in baseball? How did that?
So I think that's a great thought. Like for one, you know, to reiterate on the teachers, you know, I was very thankful that they influenced me. And that was really important because I still felt that value of how they influenced me, regardless of how they felt about things now, maybe later in their career. I really honored the fact that they still were making a difference in people's lives. And I really respected that. And I do think it's not teaching, it's all the industries, right? Where we decide like, hey, this is what I really want to do. And now I've been doing it 12 years or 20 years or 40 years, and I don't want to do it anymore. You know, like I'd like to try my hand at something else. And one of the things that really struck me was that methodical cadence of schools, which is in place for a reason, right? Like, because we can mandate the learning and it's critical to actually work that way. It just didn't serve me in my style, which was one of my superpowers was adaptability. Like, hey, how do I progress? How do I adjust on the fly? And it helped me become a really successful athlete because I could do that and recognize pivots and changes that had to work. And when that was one of the things I think I also learned was when you talked about adapting and pivoting with a higher education system that had been working really well for a lot of years, they were like, we're not interested in any of your suggestions or thoughts on adapting and pivoting. And I was like, whoa, I don't even know if I have a seat at the table. Mm-hmm. So I think the ability to get into coaching and really use those superpowers, but still be able to use all those skills that I learned from teaching and criteria and how to set up planning and what also we could do from a planning side of adapting in the middle of something when things didn't go right. Mm-hmm. And all those I just taken away from my university education mm-hmm. became so valuable in that environment. So I really kind of found my sweet spot where I really still got to teach, which I think coaching and teaching is very, you know, nearly synonymous, right? Mm-hmm. And people would probably argue a little bit about that, but it's still a chance for all the communication, the feedback, the modeling, the leadership, the influence. I think things are there for both ways and in both environments, regardless of title, right? So I think that's where I really thought my teaching would have the most influence.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you said, as a father, you've had your kids in both public, private, and homeschools. So you've seen a variety of ways that teachers have taught in a variety of models. And you've seen some of the non-traditional ways that kids can learn. So what has your perspective been as a father in seeing your own kids learn in seeing them develop?
Yeah, that's really good. I have had some very unique experiences with education.
Yeah.
And I think that it's personalized, right? I think there's a lot of different ways to learn. And I think we've really learned that one way isn't the only way, right? And I think that one of the things that really I learned from it was to keep an open mind.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I was a public school educated child, and so was my wife. And we came from a pretty good school district in Michigan and we're high school sweethearts. So we went to the same high school. And when, you know, I was probably, I'd say like, you know, not much, like, you know, 7 or 8 years removed from my university level, when all of a sudden my first son was school age and ready to enter this world that, you know, what I knew of was as a student, right? I really didn't know it that well as a teacher myself or administrator or something like that. So we did a lot of research. I mean, we really looked hard into it. And one of the things that we're always challenged in sports is recognizing the value of time, time on tension in exercising and our reps when we're working out and things like that. And so, you know, in education, it becomes how much time and efficiency can we get Dana, the athlete, in to be training, and how can we maximize her 20 minutes with the coach or her 40 minutes today in this drill? And so that time became very important. So our research immediately went to, with a public school setting or a private school setting, was, hey, how much time of learning would our child have in a school environment? Mm-hmm. And of course, the average at that time was probably 28 students to a class at elementary. And we also knew from the averages that the classes were probably moving somewhere at this pace of number 22 to number 24, right? Because the back end would probably be putting into different modalities of learning and moved into more specific educational programming for them that would help their learning styles, right? And of course the 1%, like, we couldn't all go at the top 1% because no one would keep up. Right.
Yeah.
So we started looking at that, and our first child was pretty special from an educational standpoint. He was reading at 4 and he was doing a lot of different things, having a teacher as his mom. I think his mom started homeschooling him in the womb. So, you know, it was just kind of having that, because she has a teaching degree too. And so we just looked at that and thought, wow, maybe this is a better environment for him to learn, and he can learn at his pace. And he did. And he flourished in that environment. Right. And then my number two came along, and he needed a lot more attention, right? He had a lot more dyslexia. He had dyslexia. So he had these challenges of learning that were going on and some processing challenges there. So it was so important to learn a different way, because he was so tactile. He could do anything if you showed him, right? Like, hey, did you just construct a truck? like, hey, someone showed me how to do it and I'm nine. And you're like, what? Like, but yet, you know, could add, you know, 5 and 4 and get 9, mm-hmm. you know, and like, mm-hmm. wait, that, you just did that and you can't do this. Like, why is that gap? Why are we having that in our learning? Right. Mm-hmm. So it was so educational to figure out different ways that people could learn. Now, I'm a strong proponent of the public system and the private system. And I like the education. I like what's provided. What's been so really welcoming for me, having now a high school age child right now in private school, is both public and private, what offerings there are for these kids now. Like that we never had. Like I'm 51 years old and I'm like, wait a minute, you have a bowling team and a badminton team and you have this club. And I'm like, whoa, like, the offerings that seem like to get kids involved now has really changed. Mm-hmm. And I just really admire that, you know, the school system, even though structure still has to remain, have really pivoted to make, you know, better offerings.
Yeah. And I think that that's what the schools have learned throughout the years, kind of to adapt to students' interests, adapt to, you know, their course offerings, after school activities, sports, you know, depending on, you know, their student body, right? It doesn't look like it did when we were in high school necessarily. Talk to me a little bit about some of the mentors that you had as you were moving into working with pro baseball players and some of the contacts. You talk to me in the pre-chat a little bit about somebody who there was a shoulder rehab story you know, kind of how you got into working with some of the athletes that you got contacted about the opportunities through the strength and conditioning coach.
Yeah, I think that was a big difference, right? You know, and then you talk about how education changes. You know, I felt like I had some great coaches that really helped me, you know, improve myself and get better in a lot of different ways. And primarily was mentally and physically, where I really had to learn a lot of things. And then, of course, coaches that helped us study film and learn the game better and all those good things. And but you know, along the way, I think back at how we were training and doing things back in my day, right? In my day. And you know, people do it a lot better today than we knew then. And of course, the educators are still educating, some of them even now, 25, 30 years later, and they've adapted their programs because of that. So I think that was really big for me. You know, and I think I really got an opportunity to teach and coach at that pro level because, you know, there were people that helped me along the way and I had no idea how influential they were at the time. I knew they were influencing me significantly, but on a greater stage, right? So as an athlete at the University of Toledo, Ken Manny was my strength and conditioning coach, a great educator, great model of leadership. And then he was this big name in strength and conditioning. I just knew he was helping me as an athlete. And then the idea of Nick Saban, who was our head coach at Toledo one year, who I got to know a little bit while I was there, and then got the opportunity later, because I did know him, to get on his staff at Michigan State. And so that was, you know, great opportunity because people knew who I was. And I hear a lot of people say, oh, well, you know, it's who you know, right? Dana, you know, well, it's really who knows you, because do they know you to be a dependable person, a hard worker, a person of integrity, like all those things. And if they know that, then they want you to come along. Right. And I could say, you know, I remember when I was in pro baseball, I had a chance to speak with the New York Yankees about an opportunity. And I always say, like, you know, I knew Mr. Steinbrenner, the owner of the Yankees. The problem was he didn't know me, right? Like, so, you know, when you get to an interview like that, they don't know who you are. That's challenging, right? You want to come in with something. So the reason I really felt like I got a leg up was, one, because I had these people that were advocates of mine, and they were much more influential in the community than I even knew in the sports community, as we've seen from Coach Saban's influence with, you know, another national championship 4 or 5 days ago, right? And then the other thing was that I'd played the game and experienced some of the challenges of it, from the workouts, the scheduling, and the injuries. And that was really a big deal. You know, I hurt my shoulder. I had my shoulder repaired surgically and did all the rehab. And so all that experience really helped me build compassion and empathy for the athletes who had to go through it as a career. This is my job. And And when you're so passionate about something and this is your livelihood, you know, the last thing you want is to lose that livelihood over something you don't get to control. And the moment injuries happen, it's all in doubt, right? Like your whole asset as a pro athlete is your physical body. And if your body can't perform anymore, like, oh, Dana, you got a great mind and we really love your mind and we love you, but you can't go anymore. So why don't you become a coach? That's a little bit of my story. Like, hey, you know, you're not that good of a player anymore after the surgery. Maybe you'd make a good coach. And maybe that was part of that transition too, that was going on. But I think those were the big influences, you know, minus a major influence of a mentor when I was a kid.
Yeah, that's so important to realize that, you know, those influencers really play a role in how you view your, you know, walk throughout your career. If you look back in the past 10, 15 years and how you've become a better coach yourself, right? And how you're working better with those players. Discuss a little bit about turnover, you know, in your business and also education. You know, in the summer 21, I expect we're going to see a lot of turnover teachers that are just leaving the profession, you know, after being drained from this really school year. And, you know, how you think, you know, what that means for people maybe coming into the teaching profession and also for youth that are looking for those positive influencers.
Well, what's probably changed? It's probably really nice for, I would think, the new teachers who have adapted learning styles so much. I mean, you know, when I think about when I was going through university, I went to the word processing center, right? We didn't have our own computers, right? Like, so you had to go type a paper, you had to go up to the library and the word processing center, right? So it's a very different learning now where kids are learning, like, how much do we learn now on YouTube, right? Like, we want to watch that video and say, wow, I think I could fix my car. Maybe I could redo my transmission. Like, wait, what? Like, people try it, right? Because we've got these learning. So, there's been a lot of adaptive learning now for someone who's 25, 28 years old. They've learned by phone. They've learned remotely. They've learned online. They've done courses via the phone. They've done courses by video. Obviously, in person is tough to replace, right? But we've also learned about the experiences of how people learn and how do we give them those practice reps of experience as opposed to just the book knowledge and going in and lecturing to them, like, how do we really get that? And so you see so much more now with lab work. Let's go in and practice the lab. And so I think that's adapted. And so when you really look at the 25 to 30 years old, major advantage over teachers my age who didn't have all these different styles of learning, or even more important, didn't learn how to set up and teach in those different mediums of learning. Right? So now it's like, hey, I know you've never done it, but Dana, how about you build me an online course by February 1st? That's not that long from now. Will I have time to do that? Like, and so I think that there's an advantage there. I think also that it's a tough environment. There's so many options now. One of the things that I think is really challenging in the education environment that was very different from when I was a kid is when I came up, you know, a lot of my mentors and teachers told me the same thing. You know, there was consistency and clarity in the messaging, because if I asked someone I thought was I respected, they would say, hey, Trent, this is what I think would be really good for you. And you could do that this way. And I would be like, oh, that's good advice. But you know, for my own thing, I'll ask my good friend Dana too, because she's really knowledgeable. And then you would give me something very similar, right? And it's not overt, and I don't think it's intentional, but we have different lenses now and a lot of different experiences. So it's not uncommon, I don't think, to have three different mentors or people we admire to tell us three different ways to go about our life and the next steps. And I think it leaves the learning environment confused. Like, well, I really respect Dana and I think I should go that way, but my coach says I should go this way and I really respect him. And my parents say I should go this way and I respect and honor them, right? So like, which way do I go? And there's a little, I think there's a, because of the options, that can cause some confusion.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's something a lot of new teachers are going to be finding in the next couple of years, and finding out which way to go and where to work, and you know what environment they most would want to work in. And that kind of leads us into another area, kind of when it comes to culture and climate, I wanted to discuss in terms of the teachers at the water cooler, kind of those conversations. Now, you know, they might be taking place via a Zoom meeting, but you know, those staff lounge conversations, like you experienced when you were subbing during your student teaching, of those disheartened teachers, right? How that compares to the bigger business with Major League Baseball, and you know, when people should see that, you know, the right time to leave is, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I would say that challenge is it's an alignment issue. It's a leadership issue. And I think it's industry agnostic, right? I think those conversations and challenges are happening at every level. Everyone has some ideas and we have expertise in that. And it really comes back down to, are we doing these things as an organization to continue learning and adapting to what's happening? Are we continuing to monitor our values in our organization and keeping people aligned in that? Like, hey, if the organization's values changed, or mine have, you know, that may be a sign of the times, that it's time to go and maybe something's different. But that meeting after the meeting, or the water cooler meeting, you know, that's really an alignment issue of leadership. Because do we give our folks a chance inside the organization to have their voice heard, listen to it? And do we have a structure inside the organization that says, hey, I want to communicate clearly on what direction before we communicate and get transparent about that concept? Let's do the background and engage and discuss with our team members that's going to be affected by. And what I like to say is, you know, alignment doesn't equal agreement, right? Like, if I'm going to decide what the company is going to do ultimately as the CEO, well, Dana, you know, I don't always need your agreement to make that decision, right? But I want to hear your opinion, and I want to have my team all discuss your thoughts, and I want to discuss the other team's thoughts, the team members. And when we do decide together, and maybe me unilaterally sometimes, but when we do decide what direction we're going to go, I really need us to all move in that direction. Very similar to sports, you don't see people call a huddle in football and say, okay, this is what we're going to do. Dana, we're going to give you the ball and all of us are going to run left and block for you. And I go, no, I don't think that's a good idea. You know, the right side actually seems weaker to me. So you can do whatever you want, but you know, secretly, hey, Dana, you should follow me to the right. They're not watching for this one, right? Like, wait a minute. Like, you're changing the play, Trent? Like, that's not agreement, and that's certainly not alignment, right? So we have to be able to decide as a group that this is the direction for now that we think is best. And now I just need your alignment and that you're willing to support it, even though you don't always agree with everything and the way we're doing it. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, if this conversation, like, you know what, Dana and Trent, we just disagree. It's the direction we're going, and we are willing to get an alignment on this and do it as you think. We have our reservations, but we will do it as it's our role and our job. And we do that. And then the next thing happens and we disagree again, but we're going the other direction and they don't see it our way. And then it happens again. Hey, listen, you know, three or four times, like, maybe you're not an organization that's moving the way that you see the organization, or they really don't value your opinion. And if you want to be heard, you're probably not being heard there.
Yeah.
So if those things are happening, likely a time that, hey, maybe this is my time to go. And it doesn't mean that you're right and they're wrong. It doesn't mean that you know better than they do, or they know better than you do. It just is maybe an alignment issue and a values issue and an issue of how you think maybe it could work better. Mm-hmm. And if it can work better somewhere else, I mean, this is how entrepreneurship got started, right? I don't like the way you're running your company, Dana, so I'm going to start my own.
Yeah. So,
wow, I didn't know you'd go in competition with me. Well, I know how to build the widget, and I don't think you sell it the right way, and I would sell it this way. So let's see if we can compete, and we'll both sell widgets, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's the free market system. And, you know, and I think there should be still some of that available in the education system, because it competition tends to be a good thing. It tends to make things better. And if we don't have that and we eliminate that from all of it, you know, we may get status quo, but we might not even get to that.
Mm-hmm. And I think that would, you know, be good for those innovators in education, you know, because we have a lot of people who are innovating and who are coming up with new ideas on how to do things. So like you said, you know, if you can do it better, then branch out, right? Leave the system or district that you're in and find out how you could better serve students.
How many people do you know that have, hey, my voice never got heard at the table.
Yeah.
No one ever thought I was a good idea when I was a teacher. So now I went out and created this software, and now 4,000 districts I've sold it into because they love it, right? And you're like, no, I had this one district. I could have just stayed there and implemented the software and been a hero, and I was happy there, but I just never got heard. And so I went out and I did this, and I did an online education system, and I started a charter school, and, right?
Like,
my son went to the Aviation Academy here in the in Grand Rapids here in Michigan, and you know, it was an opportunity to, hey, how do you specialize some education around aviation that kids can come in as freshmen, and by the end they have a pilot's license and they have a mechanic certification in aviation and a skill school that also specializes in math and science and STEM and STEAM, really. And so it's you know, it's exciting to see like these schools are adapting to where the learning's going. Mm-hmm. And I got an idea, and I think people are lining up to go over to that school.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And those are serving those kids' needs who want to learn, you know, aviation or whatever the specialty of the school is.
For sure.
Let's shift a little bit and tell about some tips that you would have for teachers and coaches who are working with students who want to make it to the major or minor leagues.
Yeah. So I'll tell you a story about me. And I had a great teacher, Mr. Medcalf, when I was in seventh grade English. And, you know, now I think he was calling it in before spring break, but we did we were doing English, and he decided that we were going to do career week at school, you know, the week before spring break. Right. And so, but you know, it was really valued, and you know, here it was still with me today. And he did something very unique as a dedicated teacher, and I didn't consider him that young of a teacher at that time for sure. And I was 13-14 years old at the time. The challenge was what would life look like for you when you're 30? We really had to do research every day in his class to talk about, you know, what, you know, the first day was, hey, what occupation would you want to do, and research that. And what do you think, where do you think you want to live? Let's talk about some geography. Do you want to stay here in West Michigan? Do you want to go do something else? And there were so all these challenges. And, you know, I think it was a time in my life where I took it serious because I was the youngest of four. My brother was in college playing hockey at Michigan State. He was a goalie and trying to make that team, and really just had a passion for that. And my other brother was a senior in high school. I think he was actually a junior my seventh grade year, and he became an all-state tailback, 9 yards a carry, a lot of colleges coming in and looking at him to come play for them. Mm-hmm. And my sister was just named Miss Michigan Teen. And I was like, you know, I'm better than all my brother and sister. So I was like, you know, arrogant. And I'm like, I'm going to play in the major leagues. Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, I kind of set my sight on what I was going to do. And I, you know, did the assignment and turned it in, which probably, you know, there was probably a stack of the boys, like, you know, pro athlete, fireman, you know, policeman. Yeah. Like, that's what we all wanted to be at the time. And, you know, probably there was the odd one who was like lawyer, like so all the big money jobs. Right. And so, so we did that, and, you know, I wouldn't say I never thought about it again, but certainly, you know, it was the assignment. It was turned in. Now, something very influential happened about 2 years after that. It was between my freshman and sophomore year in high school. I was a pretty good baseball player, and there was a camp in my local area, and I'd been working hard to get better. I hadn't grown, so I was smaller than everybody else, but I was working out a lot to lift weights, to get stronger, to compete, and probably where my passion started in strength and conditioning. And there was this camp, and it was one of the only kind back then of a showcase camp, right?
Yeah.
And so I was like, man, it was like the Willy Wonka golden ticket. Like if you got an invite, it was like, whoa, I'm in, right? And so I played for a pretty good travel team, and me and a couple of players on our team got the invite, right? And I was like, yeah, like, and you had like a month or two before the camp. And so I just put my head down and really worked at it and kind of set my intentions in motion, and, you know, talked to a couple teachers about what I was trying to do. And they were like, oh yeah, pro baseball player, you know, only one in like 1.3 million actually make it in the pros. And I was like, oh my gosh, like what? Like, I don't know. I just want to be a pro player. Like, why are you talking about the odds and
how
all stacked against me? And you should really get a backup plan because, you know, and in all well intended, but people I respected. And I was hearing things like, you know, you're not big enough. You're not fast enough. You're not strong enough. And in my mind, I was just hearing, you know, you're not enough, Trent.
Yeah.
And so I started this kind of mode, and I was fighting myself, I think, in a lot of ways to overcome that. And, you know, I was trying to read some positive, you know, literature, you know, I think I can, you know, the little engine that could. And what are these stories of overcomers in life? And when I got to the camp that summer, I was very motivated and driven, but I was also hurt and really a little frustrated about what this looked like. But I was excited to be where I was at the time. And, you know, as fate had it, like, I was ready, prepared. I had the best week of my life. And it was so important to me because if you were named the MVP, you got to sit down with a one-on-one session with the person who ran it. And this man happened to have played in the major leagues for a long time, right? Mm-hmm. So I was like, he was the only guy I knew who played pro baseball. So I got this award, and I was like, I get to sit down with the guy. I was all nervous and excited. And this was like one of really my really remembered first mentoring lessons, right? Which was, I sat down and he said, Trent, what do you want to do? And I said, well, you know, with respect, like, I want to do what you did. I want to play in the major leagues. And he said, you can do it. I've seen you play and you can do it. And I'm like, wow. Like, really? And he was like, and he kind of took back, like, yeah, I think you can do it. And I was like, you know, with all due respect, like, everybody else is telling me no. They're telling me, you know, I'm not this, I'm not that. These are the odds. You know, they're my parents, my teachers, my coaches that I know that I respect and admire some. And he's like, yeah, thought about it. And he said, you know, any of them play in the major leagues? And I said, hope, right? Hope all the matter. No, none of them had, right? And he said, you know, I'm going to caution you, Trent, on where you get advice from and what they know about it before you go asking people for advice, because it's going to serve you really well to go find the people that really have known and done it and have experience and have that share in their lives to be able to help you along. And I was like, wow, yes, sir. I will do that from here on out. And I mean, from that moment on, you know, I absolutely disdain today when people say, you know what you should do? I don't like to shit on people. Like, you know, Dana, you should run your podcast like this. You know what you should do? Like, I'm not qualified. Like, I'm not a podcast expert. I've just been in the trenches. I don't know how to get out of them, right? So like, you're an expert in education. You understand these trenches environments. And for me to think that I know is bonkers. And that really helped me along, go, hey, my teachers are teaching me subject expertise and they know this, and I listen to them and I gauge their knowledge, and I'm thankful that they pass that along to me, and that's so valued. But I also have to caution, like, hey, should they be giving me advice on, you know, how to do my job after school, or how I start a business if they've never done that, right? Like, and all these things. So I really had to gauge that much differently in my life from that conversation. And that changed things for me, because it really helped me start understanding where I'm going to get better help. And so for teachers, you know, I think none of those teachers at that time were ill-intentioned. In fact, I think they were really looking out for my best interest, because I didn't ever play in the major leagues, right? So like I did have to pivot. And because of what they taught me, I had a college degree to fall back on. I had an opportunity to know people in organizations that knew about education and valued it. And that was really critical to feel appreciated in your role with any organization. And so I think it really served me taking a lot of that good advice, but it hurt. I mean, in that moment, it was painful. And some of that I think is tough love. And that's somewhat of a job of an educator, right? I look at these days now and I feel like accountability is a four-letter word, right? Like, wait a minute. No, like it's my job as a teacher. These kids have to know that on Friday, this is the deadline. You know, past that, you know, you will be marked down. You will lose grade. You will lose opportunity because our lives fill on timelines. We have accountability in this life. And that's just as important a teacher that they're teaching as the X's and O's of the math, right? So I think it's well-intentioned and I think it's tougher than ever for these educators.
Yeah. And I like how you bring that kind of full circle in that story, how, you know, you experienced a lot of these teachers giving you that tough love. And then that player at the camp was able to say, hey, you could do it. However, the fact that you did get that degree to fall back on and how you mentioned earlier in the recording about you were able to get skills through the education degree to use with coaching. So, you know, it's kind of a full circle story you just told. So I really liked how that came, you know, how you're reflecting back on that now.
Yeah. Let me close that circle, by the way, with this great teacher who, when I took that assessment in that career week, you know, Prince's song, Party Like It's 1999 was the song of the day, yeah. Right? Like, it was like, it was hot, you know, yeah. It was like 1983, you know, and I'm thinking 1999, you know how far that is away?
Yeah.
Like, I'm like going, oh my gosh, like I'll probably be 80. Like I can't do the math, right? Like you're going to be 30. All right. Mm-hmm. So on December 31st, 1999, I turned 30. And so I was coming in and I was coming home to see my parents for the holidays. And I arrived home and, you know, this is Y2K, right? Like the next day, like everything's going to fall apart, right? The banks have an extra decimal and, you know, we got zeros. And I showed up at home and my mother said, hey, a letter came from you from school.
Okay.
And I was like, well, you know, of course that's my alumni association. Yeah, like, yeah. Hey, you're a big guy in the pros. Send us the college back some money. And I'm like, no. She's like, no, it's not from the college. It's from the grade school. It's from the local district. I'm like, oh, that's pretty cool. They probably want me to come in and speak. I did a lot of that. And I open up this letter and it's my assignment.
Oh, wow.
And he wrote, hey, how'd you do?
Oh my gosh.
And I was like, no way. And I was like, listen, this is gone. This is out of my realm since 1983. And I turned to my wife and I was like, I totally remember this assignment. Like right now, like I totally remember this. And so I came in there and I opened up this sheet. And the first thing it said was, what would you be doing right after high school? What would your next step be once you leave? And I said, well, I will be playing baseball at Arizona State University, right? Yeah. And like, you know, that was the best college baseball team in the country. And I wanted to go to university. and of course it was, you know, it's Arizona, right? Like I'm in Michigan freezing. And I did not do that. I went and played baseball and tennis at the University of Toledo. And the next thing was that, what would you be doing now at 30 years old? And I said, well, I'll be playing Major League Baseball. That was my career day. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I was coaching for the Los Angeles Angels at that time. Like I said, never made it to the pros, to the major leagues. And so it was fun. I had a great ride as a coach and it was really invigorating. And then, so I was doing that right in that moment. And then the next thing was where would you be living? And I said, I'll be living in Arizona in my golf and tennis community because I love playing golf. I love playing tennis. And as a Michigan kid, I was so tired of snow. I was like, I got to get out of here. You know, like, I'm tired of playing cold baseball games and cold football games. And I just want to be in the sun, you know? And I had flown in the night before from my home in a golf mm-hmm. and tennis community in Arizona. And the third thing said, you know, what would your personal life be like? Would you be married or what would that look like? And I said, I would be married to a blonde girl that was taller than me. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't that hard to find at 5'6", I'll be honest. But, you know, I did do that, you know, and I was married to her and still am married to her 25 and a half years later. Right. And then the last thing it said was, would you have a family? And I said, yeah, I'll have a son. And my son, Noah, who's now 22, he was coming home for his first Christmas. Uh-huh. He was a year and a half old. And so the first one was kind of, you know, 6 months, you're kind of not really there. Now yeah. it's Santa and the whole thing, right? And so I point that out of like how that man and that teacher's assignment like shaped things for me. Like yeah. I really love that he opened my eyes to goals and how those work and how those could create focus in my life. And even though I never saw that assignment again, you know, it wasn't like we teach now, right? I own a leadership yeah. company, right? We like, look at your goals. Like once a week, you look at your goals, right? I'm thinking, man, I haven't seen this in like 17 years.
Yeah.
Right. But yet how it shaped my decisions, right? I wanted to go be a college athlete and get a scholarship. And you can't be making trouble at school with the coaches. You can't get kicked off teams. You can't have a drug charge. You can't have, you know, so all of a sudden I'm picking my friends like, man, my friends are kind of going on. A couple went in off to the wrong direction, making yeah. bad choices. Great people, bad choices, right? And I'm like, oh, I got to distance myself. I can't be caught in those choices, even by association. Mm-hmm. Because I don't have the luxury of having every college in the world wanting me to come play. I just need one that will tell me, come on, man, you're our guy. Right. And so I think about how many decisions that shaped and choices I made because he gave me that assignment and what I would choose to do in moments. Now, I will tell you, Dana, it's not like I always made the right decisions, right?
Yeah.
I got in my share of trouble. I was still a teenager. Right. But for the most part, it really shaped me in those goals. And now you think about that, holding that up 17 years later and why I chose what I chose, mm-hmm. you know, that's part of my superpower. I got a vision based on what Mr. Midcalf asked me to do. And I created that vision as best I could in my mind of how that might shape me. And I just think of the hundreds of teachers and parents of my friends and coaches that helped shape that for me. And it's a big deal to me.
That's so interesting to hear that story and how that really inspired you and how you remembered it back, you know, in 99 and also today, this many years later, that teacher that really, you know, that assignment, that's just such a incredible story to hear. Out of everything we talked about today on the podcast, what's one thing in particular you'd like listeners to remember?
Well, I think that for me, when you're talking about out of the trenches, right, it is so important of your belief system and how you talk to yourself. Like,
yeah.
I guarantee you that you have what it takes. I guarantee you sitting here right here, you have what it takes. Mm-hmm. You may not know where to find it. You may not feel like it all the time, but there is that mirror check where you got to look in sometimes, and sometimes you have to convince yourself and look directly dead eye in that mirror and like, I've got what it takes.
Yeah.
Regardless of what everybody else might be saying to you, regardless of what the media says and what this person says and what that, you know, I'm always shocked as an educator, how much people think about what other people think of them.
Yeah.
And I think they're going to absolutely be astonished to find out that people actually rarely think of them. Like mm-hmm. we're thinking about ourselves. Like I'm not thinking about that person. I'm thinking about my stuff. Like people are not focused on you and you do have what it takes. Don't let them tell you different.
Great. I think those are great words to end on. And where can people find you online and connect with you?
Yeah. So I am at Trent@leadershipity.com. Leadershipity.com is our website. And I'm on Instagram @leadershipity. I'm on Twitter @Trent M. Clark. And the same for LinkedIn, Trent M. Clark. And so find me all there anytime. You can find me anywhere in the world speaking somewhere. I'm doing that a lot. Although in these COVID days, it might be a little different, but often around and in the scope of things, always working to help people get better.
Great. It was so great talking with you today on the Out of the Trenches podcast. Have a great rest of your day.
Thank you, Dana, for having me. Honored to be a guest.